This episode of the Memory Palace is brought to you by Progressive. Progressive helps you compare direct auto rates from a variety of companies, so you can find a great one, even if it's not with them. Quote today at Progressive.com to find a rate that works with your budget. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. This is the Memory Palace. I'm Nate DeMeo. When they mention her, if they mention her, in some small aside in some large history, or in a post highlighting unsung heroes of the civil rights movement, Bernice Robinson is the beautician who taught people to read. And this is true, but as with most things, not so simple. It was kept simple by the leaders of the movement itself. Specifically, it seems, by Miles Horton, a white activist who founded and led the Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, on the notion that the best activists and organizers, the best people to change communities, came from the communities themselves. And so when he wrote his own story, looking back on his vital, truly, I don't come here to denigrate Miles Horton of all people. When he wrote about his own role in the movement, Bernice's story helped to bolster it and to make the case for his vision of change, of local people, indigenous people, working people, teaching people just like them. No one coming down from ivory towers, no one so laden with accreditations and pedagogy that they lost their ability to lift anyone up. So Bernice Robinson's story was kept simple, like they did with Rosa Parks, who was for so long the seamstress, solely, tired and fed up, stumbling into history by refusing to stand, instead of an activist, trained and tested. And so I will use the time you have granted me here, short though it is, to simply tell you more about Bernice Robinson. The ninth child of James, a bricklayer, and Martha, a seamstress, born in 1914 on the first snow day in Charleston, South Carolina that anyone could remember. She went to school until ninth grade, which was as long as Jim Crow allowed. So her parents sent her up to Harlem, where a sister had moved some time before, and where she could keep going to school. And this too is a simple thing that you likely know about race in America then, that a child would simply not be allowed to go to school in one state, but be allowed in another because of the circumstances of her birth. You've heard that before, and I can't make you hear it anew just by saying it now, but I wish I could. So she went to school in New York, and did well, and went out to hear music at the Apollo, at theaters and dance halls, and sat where she wanted, or could afford to anyway. Color of your skin didn't matter. This didn't happen at home. There were no theaters or dance halls, just the movies, segregated, balconies for the black folks. She graduated, took a civil service exam and got a job, a white-collar clerical job, commensurate with her education and her test scores, the way it was supposed to work. It would do, the job, more than do for a kid not long out of high school, who not long before had been told by her home state that she couldn't even go to high school. She wanted to be a musician, but who knew? Maybe someday she would be. A job doesn't have to be your life. It could be the thing that buys you the freedom to find one. But life found her back in Charleston in 1947. Her parents were getting old. She found it hard to be home, like in those stories you've heard of black soldiers returning to America after the war, having seen other ways of living overseas. That was New York for her. There were places freer than home. She knew that now. She tried to get a job like the one she'd had up north, but as a black person, she was barred from taking civil service exams, shut out of any kind of white-collar work. And so her brothers took a sledgehammer, some primer and paint, remodeled a garage, put in a couple of chairs and a sink, and she became a beautician. And she used the freedom of that job, of being her own boss, of setting her own hours, to find her life. She worked voter registration drives in her free time, mailed flyers for local candidates. And in the summer of 55, she closed up shop for a bit to travel to Tennessee to attend a workshop at the Highlander Folk School run by the United Nations. Her cousin Septima Clark was there. Rosa Parks was there too, a few months before she would play her instrumental role in the Montgomery bus boycott. And over the course of the workshop, in some breakout session, though they probably didn't call them that then, or just over a bag lunch, or during a walk on a dappled path beneath tall poplars, her cousin Septima, a longtime educator and education activist, talked up her plan to start a school like Highlander on John's Island in South Carolina. It is just off Charleston, 20 minutes or so from downtown now with no traffic. But at the time, it was a world away. The legacy of slavery hung even heavier there. Dirt roads, dilapidated houses, nearly entirely cut off from public utilities and services, barely funded schools that left most people on the island with educations that usually stopped at second or third grade. Her cousin's idea was that the school would teach adults to read so they could pass the literacy tests that by design kept so many black citizens from voting. Her idea was that Bernice would teach them. Bernice protested, said she didn't know how to teach, she'd never learned, and her cousin said that was the point. She had lived. She knew how to talk to the people who came into her shop. And it was her shop. No white boss could fire her when they found out that she was a radical who wanted to teach people to read. Bernice Robinson showed up on a January evening in a wood-paneled room in the back of a food co-op with a voter registration form, a rolled-up copy of the UN Charter she planned to tack up on the wall, and some old borrowed elementary school textbooks. There were 14 adults there wondering whether she had it in her to teach them, and she told them she wasn't sure, that she was more nervous than they were, but if this thing worked right, they all might learn something from each other, and she would give it a shot if they would. Her students didn't want the textbooks, it turned out. It was demeaning to be treated like a child when you weren't a child. And so she asked them what they wanted to read. They'd start there instead. It was the small print on money orders, birthday cards, the Bible, the paper. She wrote up her own primers, stories that wove in words from their lives in John's Island, the language of the land and their work and their days. A beautician talking to a maid or a farmer or a factory worker. She figured out how to teach these 14 people to read and write letters to the people they loved. Taught a dock worker enough math so he could be sure he wasn't being cheated out of hours. Taught them how to shop for themselves from a catalog without needing to ask for help. And after 5 months, 14 adults could read well enough that they could read passages of the Constitution aloud, so they could be allowed to vote. A simple thing that wasn't at all. And Bernice Robinson continued to work for years after that, in the beauty shop and in the movement. As it grew, as the nation came to know its leaders, some of them anyway, as its television cameras turned to the marches and the protests and the speeches, but rarely to the work that happened in the kitchens and the neighborhoods and the beauty shops, never noted how much of the work happened after work, or how Bernice Robinson taught people to read so they could vote and find their own lives. This episode of The Memory Palace is written and produced by me, Nate DeMayo. I get research assistance from Eliza McGraw and engineering assistance from Elizabeth Aubert. The show is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX, a network of independently owned and operated podcasts. If you want to support what we do, you can do that financially by donating. Go to radiotopia.fm/donate. And you can tell someone about the show. Send them a favorite episode. Pick up their phone, find their podcast app, secretly subscribe them. Hopefully they'll be happy about that later on. You can rate and review this podcast, which is a thing you hear all the time on other podcasts. But there is a reason it totally helps. Clicking 5 stars, writing a little review on your podcast app pushes their algorithms in such a way that it helps people find this show. I'm glad you found the show. If you ever want to drop me a line, you can at nate@thememorypalace.us. You can follow me at Twitter or Facebook at The Memory Palace. And that's what I got for you today. Talk to you in a couple weeks. Thank you.
Radiotopia.
From Pierre.